But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire. But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire. Good morning and welcome to Playing with Fire, Long Island's only food, wine, and lifestyle show. I'm your host, Tom Shodell, and I'm here with co-host Stu Schrager. Good morning, Stu.
Good morning, Tom. I feel so lonely.
Lonely? What's happening?
After that show last week when you brought the...
I had the kids here, yeah.
Kids in, yeah.
Yeah, it was fun. It was fun to do. I mean, they were all excited. You know, we listened to the show, and it was just a lot of fun to hear it again, you know.
Well, it really was.
It's always a... Excuse me, it's always a gamble because, you know, with kids, you never know what they're going to come out with, you know. They say the damnedest things, as Art Linkletter used to say, you know. No, remember that show with Art Linkletter with the kids? Art Linkletter was a TV host years ago, back in the late 50s, early 60s, and he used to interview children, you know, and they would do this whole show over these interviews with these kids that were like 5, 6, 7 years old, and the stuff they would come out with was just priceless, absolutely priceless. Well, you know, being a grandpa, that, you know,
yeah,
they say some incredible stuff.
I repeat myself, but your granddaughter, she has the poise of a teenager.
Yeah, they grow up quicker. I don't know. I guess it's the internet or something. You know, they have access to information that we never had as kids. So you know, hopefully it's all for the better. I fear for the worst, but I'm hoping for the best. You know, so I didn't get a chance to talk about, I spent 4 days in New Orleans a week and a half ago, and I hadn't been there in a long time. I hadn't been there in like 20 years, you know, and it was, you know, New Orleans is kind of stuck in this time warp, you know, because, you know, I always stay in the Quarter, the French Quarter, and it hasn't changed since the late 1700s. I mean, it's just, it is what it is. I mean, obviously, there's a lot more T-shirt shops now than there was when Jean Lafitte was plying the streets there. But, you know, the music and the architecture, the buildings, it's really kind of, it's almost like a movie set. You know, you go down there and it's like almost hard to believe that it's still the same way it was back, way back when. And you know, the juxtaposition of the, the French Quarter with the rest of the city, it almost reminds me of Boston a little bit in that, you know, you go to Boston, you see all these old buildings, you know, yes, like from the Revolutionary War, and then right next to it, it's a skyscraper with all glass, and, you know, it's kind of weird, you know.
Well, that's what I like about some of the college campuses. I have to admit, I haven't been to a lot, but the few that I have, and if they have like a quad, which is the center of the campus, many times it's a mix of, classic architecture, and then there's modern, you know, thrown in.
Yeah, yeah. No, the interesting part about New Orleans is the French Quarter is obviously sequestered by itself down there, and it's, you know, it's kind of on its own. But, you know, some of the others, like Boston, you know, they're right next to each other, some of these things, and it's just incredible to see. But anyway, I do the food, wine, and music thing when I'm down there. It's really all I'm down there for. And the great part about the French Quarter is 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock in the morning, there's live bands playing. You know, maybe they probably start at 10, I would think. But there's a place called Legends Park, and it's right across from where I was staying at the Royal Sonesta. And I had a balcony looking over Bourbon Street, you know, and the Legends Park was right across the street, and the band would start at 10 in the morning, you know.
Really?
Yeah, go out there and have a cup of coffee on the balcony and just listen to some, I guess they call it jazz. It's more like that New Orleans funk thing now. It's changed a little bit, but just an awful lot of fun. And, you know, live bands going all day long up and down Bourbon Street. You know, there's a lot of restaurants there, and I tend to do... when I go there, I tend to do like the local cuisine things, you know, the Creoles and the gumbos and the jambalayas and the etouffees and the alligator, that kind of stuff. I tend to do that for lunch. And then at night, I really want to be inspired. So I go to all the really high-end restaurants and check them out. And I got to tell you, I was to three very, very cool high-end restaurants. One called Lillet, which Val found, actually. I didn't find it. And it was out of the Quarter on Magazine Street, which is probably, I don't know, a 10-minute cab ride or whatever. But really cool French bistro. They had An interesting wine list, and I found a wine from Jura there, and most people don't know about that area in France. It's in southeastern France, and right by the Swiss-German border there, by Alsace. And they make they grow a couple of interesting grapes there. They grow Pinot Noir, red grapes. They grow Pinot Noir. They grow Trousseau, and they grow Arbois, and Poulsard. So does Arbois the area, but Poulsard is they're grapes that a lot of people aren't familiar with. But if you ever get a chance, they're some of the most interesting grapes I've ever had. You know, the Pinot Noir is kind of cool, but with Pinot Noir, I tend to stay in Loire and Burgundy. The Pinot Noir is a decent, but really it's the Trousseau and the Poulsard, and they do a lot of blends with those three grapes. And the wines are just spectacular. They don't really export a lot, and they keep them to themselves, you know, much like the Swiss do. You know, there's great wine being made in Switzerland, but they don't export a lot of it because they don't make a lot of it. But the wines in Jura are really interesting. So anyway, long story short, found a wine from Jura.
And it just happened to be on their list?
Yeah. It was on the list, on the red wine list. And I think I'll pick the restaurant because of the wine list, because she knows I'm a wine head. So anyway, that was the first night. The second night, we went to a place called Bayona, which has been in the French Quarter for a long, long time. I think it's on Dauphine Street. And I've known about it for 20 years. I think they've been there for maybe even 30 years now. They've been there a long, long time. And it was opened by a chef who was a pretty, you know, well-known, well-regarded woman chef down there called Susan Spicer. And she opened this place called Bayona. And a testament to her talent, I mean, it's there 30 years later. There's not a lot of restaurants that can say that. So we went there. And again, great, great dinner. Had a, you know, a bunch of interesting things. And, you know, had a lamb dish. And we had a redfish. And, you know, great bottle of wine. It was very cool. And then the last night, I saved the best for last. You know, I always say I can tell kind of the, you know, the quality of a restaurant's kitchen by reading the menu. There's certain tells that you can, you know, that I can see, you know, as far as ingredients go or techniques go, where I can kind of tell the talent level in the kitchen. And so I looked at this place August and I was like really impressed. So I said, okay, let's go there. And we went there the third night and it was just spectacular. It was a really, really fine restaurant on a par with anything I've ever eaten in anywhere in the country. And I got talking to the sommelier, and he asked me, you know, where I was from. I guess he heard the accent or whatever. So I said, New York, what are you doing down here? I said, I'm in a restaurant business. Just came down to eat and, you know, and listen to music for a couple of days, a little break. So they actually brought out an extra appetizer, kind of a professional courtesy thing, and, you know, said, oh, this is with the chef, and, you know, welcome to August and whatever. It was great. It was just a really, really fine meal, great wines, service was killer. Just, you know, it's nice to kind of get out of your zone and just see what other people are doing in different cities. You know, I take these little trips all the time, you know, to different cities around the country. And, you know, it's a little 2 or 3 day thing just to go and trash the restaurants. And I can't think of a better way to spend 3 days.
No, for sure. But, you know, I'm very much a fan of these reviews that you do on these gauntlets that you take.
Mm-hmm.
This one I had to double check you. I have friends that are in New Orleans.
Uh-huh.
And I threw the names out at her.
Uh-huh.
And this is what I got back. They're all good. Hated them all.
Hated them all or hated them all?
Eight.
Oh, okay.
A-T-E-E.
All right.
August is very high end.
Yes.
Lillette is a Magazine Street fave.
Yes.
Bayona is a Susan Spicer restaurant, highly rated too.
Yeah, there you go. So I got the approval of the locals, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, even the local stuff. I mean, you know, we had lunch at a place called the Gumbo Shop. And it's down and dirty. It's the building's been there since the 1700s. You know, the waitress was great, this middle-aged woman. She kept calling me boo-boo and baby, and it was hilarious. But, you know, I had a chicken and andouille gumbo, I think. Val had a seafood gumbo, whatever. It's fun to go down there and explore, you know, especially during the day when, you know, I don't really eat a lot during the day. I tend to try and keep it to one meal, especially when I'm going nuts like that. But Gumbo Shop is great, and it's on St. Peter Street, which is right off off Bourbon. And we found this place, this oyster bar called Fives, which is down by Jackson Square. And I got to tell you, really, really good oysters. They had a selection. There was some oysters from Alabama. They had oysters from Alabama, from Louisiana, from Maine, and Prince Edward Island. With a really interesting little wine list. You know, we drank some Albarino with the oysters, which is always a great pairing. But you know what they did, Stu? You know that sauce that you have trouble pronouncing? The minuet thing? Go ahead.
Minuet.
No, that's the dance. Mignonette.
Mignonette.
Anyway, they made theirs with a little bit of ginger juice, which was, I tell you what, I was a little worried because ginger has a pretty strong flavor, but it was so well blended in this mignonette that it just complemented the oysters. I thought it was great. You know, I may even steal that one. You know,
so I have to delve into the mignonette.
There you go. That's one in a row.
So, a couple of weeks ago, I mentioned that I was at a restaurant that had a sort of a chopped salad that was cucumber, tomato.
Yeah.
No lettuce. It was just vegetables,
right.
String beans, I think, shrimp, sometimes a little bacon chips.
Right.
Sometimes it has egg in it. Well, interesting enough, just while we're talking about it, crumbled bacon can sometimes be a real nice additive. And other times it can be just ridiculous. To me, if it's too well done,
mm-hmm.
and small pieces, it's like pebbles, and it just
it's annoying.
Doesn't have taste.
Yeah,
and all it does is crack in your mouth. But the string that brings this story forward is I said that it seemed like they just poured red wine vinegar over it without any other seasoning. And again, listening to your granddaughter talk about having oysters, and as she said, slurping them down,
yeah.
Which is definitely a great foodie term.
Yeah.
But mignonette can sometimes be a little too strong.
Astringent. Yeah.
And I just wonder what the perfect recipe is, because in my world, I guess I like food naked and plain.
Mm-hmm.
If there's a sauce that's too rich, it's the sauce you're eating, and it's weird how they pair it with something so that that's a meal.
Yeah.
So again, if chicken is tasteless, and then they put I'm probably using the wrong choice, but a béarnaise sauce on the chicken,
right?
And all you taste is the sauce. Like, why not just put it on a piece of bread or something?
Yeah, well, you know, mignonette to me is almost like a culinary no-no, and for a couple of reasons. One is, first of all, the classic mignonette is made with red wine vinegar, shallot, and red pepper and black pepper.
And that was also when your grand, you know, she didn't say diced onion; she said shallot.
Yeah, she knows. I think what the problem with that to me is that oysters, unlike clams, are different, right? So depending on where, where they're grown and how they're grown, oysters taste different. There's some that are coppery, there's some that are lemony, there's some that have that saline quality. So there's all kinds of different nuances in the tasting of oysters. And that's why if you go to a real oyster bar, they'll give you a choice of, like, you know, they usually do a sampler platter, like three from New Brunswick, three from New England, three from Long Island, and three from the West Coast or something like that. So you have you can taste the different nuances in different growing areas and different water temperatures. But once you put red wine vinegar on something, all you taste is red wine vinegar. And red wine vinegar is the antichrist when it comes to wine. You know what I mean? It just, it's, you know, you don't want to mix red wine vinegar and wine because it just kills the taste of the wine. So when I make a mignonette, I tend to use cucumber juice and verjus. And verjus is the unfermented juice from grapes. And it can be anywhere from sweet to really, you know, kind of vinegary and acidic. But it doesn't have that sharp bite that the red wine vinegar has. And I think, you know, white balsamic vinegar is the same way. It's softer, you know. And you can almost make a case, I mean, for doing that. Because some people don't like the plain oysters, right? I'm just a lemon guy. I like lemon, maybe sometimes a little bit of horseradish or whatever. But, you know, if there's an interesting mignonette like I had in Fives in New Orleans, I'll give that a shot. I thought the ginger was a great addition and a little PO that I never thought of it, honestly, you know. But that's my point in going out. I mean, as much experience as I have in the kitchen in all these years, I mean, 55 years in the kitchen, I mean, I've seen a lot of stuff. I've eaten out at crazy levels forever. But every once in a while, you go, whoa, there's a good idea. And so that's the reason I never stop pursuing. You know, you never really know it all, you know what I mean? You're always learning. And I think even for the amateur cook or just the foodie in general, those experiences just... You know, whether you're trying to build a repertoire to cook or you just want to build a repertoire of memories in your head about great food, going out and getting out of your lane sometimes and trying some things that you never had before is so important to that education.
So here we go. I went to breakfast after the show last week.
Uh-huh.
And I was with a buddy of mine. He just lost his wife. Figured it would be the right thing to try to
cheer him up a little bit. Yeah, right?
not smother him, but at any rate, we went to a restaurant in Lynbrook called Lynbrook Eats. It's sort of a dinerish local place,
right?
And they had, I guess, like a Sunday brunch type menu, but they had like. Different versions of Eggs Benedict.
Yeah.
They had traditional, which I guess was with Canadian ham.
Canadian bacon, yeah.
Canadian bacon.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had some wild ones. They had one that I didn't really understand, and it was a crab cake. And I didn't know if that really went.
Yeah, I've done those.
Really?
Yeah.
And I say that, and then the Lord above shocks me. Because I'm watching my favorite show, Below Deck, and the chef comes up with lobster eggs.
I've done that one too.
Which that I sort of felt. Again, on the menu from where I was, it was the traditional. They had the crab cake. They had like one with smoked salmon lox, essentially.
Yeah.
I almost went with that, and then I said, I don't know. That's, you know, is it irreverent?
Well, that goes against the Jewish tradition, you know, kind of thing.
I didn't know, because that be said, it lox, eggs, and onion.
Yeah.
Is a
yeah for sure.
Like a
good scramble.
Soul food.
Yeah, it's a good scramble.
But I didn't do the I didn't do the salmon one, and I. In retrospect, maybe I should have, especially since, again, I got kicked in the butt when I saw the one with the lobster one on the TV show. But I wanted to just quickly ask that it's a hollandaise sauce, not a...
Yeah, hollandaise.
And what's the difference between hollandaise and béarnaise?
Béarnaise has an addition of... when you make béarnaise, what you do is you take... fresh tarragon and you steep it down with peppercorns and shallots in vinegar until the vinegar is almost evaporated, so it flavors that vinegar, and then you whip that strained vinegar into hollandaise, and then you add some, I add some chopped, some people don't, but I add some chopped tarragon leaves to it also. So it's basically a tarragon flavored hollandaise.
So I tasted like a lemon tang, I believe it was.
Yeah, well, in hollandaise has lemon. That's, okay. Yeah.
So, but it was a refreshing item, and again, I think
you had the lobster.
No, I went with the traditional, and I.
You're such a
I
wuss.
I think I should have gotten out of my lane.
Yeah, yeah.
And been a little more adventurous in the worst situation. How bad could it be? Because you know it's one meal, and worst comes to worst, you have a poached egg and English muffin.
Yeah.
Push off the other stuff. I just, again, the crab cake just seemed not the way to go.
Have you not been listening? Treat every meal like it was your last. You know, you have to kind of, I think that people should push themselves. I once had a friend of mine give me advice on real estate. And he said to me, whenever you buy in real estate, extend yourself a little, because 5 years from now, that payment won't be so painful. And it's the same thing with food. I always tell people, you know, extend yourself a little. See something interesting on the menu and give it a shot. Worst come to worst, you can have another meal in like 4 or 5 hours. What's
That's
the
true.
Big deal?
That's
you know what
true.
I mean? It's
That's
not
true.
Like it's the last one. So
going back to the Bernays real quick, is that mostly a steak? A beef?
They use it. Well, I have fish too, but they use it mostly on steak. You know, it's considered. You know, I don't really make them anymore for a couple of reasons. First of all, people don't eat them like they used to. Second of all, they're kind of volatile. You know, there's you got raw egg yolks in there basically, and I mean they're cooked to some degree, but you know the bottom line is they're not always cooked all the way, and you know there's always that sitting around thing, and you know I worry about the bacteria contents of most of that stuff. I guess they sell some now, powdered crap or whatever you can, you know, some people use. But so the bottom line is I stay away from them. I'd rather have, I'd rather do a sort of a cream sauce or whatever, you know. When I make Eggs Benedict, you know, sometimes they'll request that for brunch at a club or something. I'll use it. I'll make hollandaise. It's not a big deal. But it's not one of the things that I use on any of my menus, you know.
I also had the chance this past week to visit one of the North Shore's top steak restaurants. Which will go nameless.
Oh, no. What but, happened?
So it was...
You'd name it if it was great.
a fundraising type of thing. Choice of different entrees.
I'm surprised you have any funds left after all the fundraisers you go to.
yeah, I'm always giving it away.
You are.
But the choices on the menu for the night was filet mignon.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a big filet
Boring.
Guy.
Boring.
Right. Yeah. I'd rather have a strip steak or something.
Ribeye or something.
And actually, what was funny is, you know, people went, you know, $1,000 for this little thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
but
it's the charity.
And I tried to do right. I didn't order medium well. I ordered medium. And it came out perfect inside. It was a little crispy outside. But... where I'm going is it was plated on a bed of mashed potatoes
mm-hmm.
with, I guess it was like a sherry
mm-hmm.
Sauce.
Yeah.
Didn't like the sherry sauce, so mm-hmm. that sort of ruined the mashed potatoes for me.
Yeah.
And then when I thought the spinach would, you know,
rescue
bring it,
it
home, I found that way too salty. So... again, it turns out it was a good cut of meat, just didn't get it there.
You know why spinach is always salty in restaurants? And I go through this all the time with my guys. If you saute, like if you have, let's say the average size bedroom in a house on Long Island is what, 15 by 15 or 20 by 20. If you fill that with spinach... and sauteed it, you'd get about 3 orders, right? It just goes down to nothing. And what young cooks do is they see all that spinach and they put enough salt in it to, you know, in their mind to, you know, salt that much spinach. Then it shrinks down to nothing, but the salt doesn't go away. So there's always, almost always, too much salt in spinach because they don't realize that you have to use very little because it's going to shrink down to nothing. I've been fighting this battle for 30 years, you know.
It's funny. I usually like things, you know, perfectly seasoned, whatever that means.
Yeah.
And I got a kick out of something because at the dinner, you know, somebody said, you know, I had some bronzino the other day. It was a little too fishy for me.
Yeah, well, yeah.
But
well,
many times I'll use... the spinach is the way to, again, balance the meal. A lot of times steaks get seasoned too much. So, again, that sort of will take it down a notch, but it didn't work this time. What are you going to do?
Yeah, it's one meal. Four hours later, you have another one. It's no big deal, you know. I think, you know, to me, filet mignon is the most boring of all steaks. I just went through this with my... my chef partner out east in Allure, Jeff the chef. And Jeff and I were doing the menus because we're opening up Allure next week, you know. And we're opening up a couple of weeks early because we had some person who booked a party for the following weekend and wound up canceling. So now we're opening up 2 weeks earlier because the numbnuts couldn't figure out, you know, what he wanted to do. Anyway, long story short, we're doing the menu, right? So we have a steak on the menu, and, you know, Allure's on the water. You've been there, haven't you?
Yes.
Have you been? Yes, it's on the water, so it's mostly a seafood place. But you always have to have the nod to, you know, some non-seafood people, which I never got. I mean, I did a place called Ocean Bistro in Locust Valley years ago, which was really the first only seafood restaurant on Long Island. And, you know, there was so much, you know, hooting and hollering about why can't I get a chicken? Why can't I get a steak? We eventually put a steak on the menu. So we're looking at the non-seafood items, right? We have a burger out there, which, you know, fine. We have a strip steak out there, which is fine. There's a chicken Milanese, which, you know, if you don't like seafood, you can cop to, which is fine. So Jeff says, should we put another steak on the menu, like a ribeye, right? Now, I like ribeyes. I think the ribeyes, to me, it's the best tasting steak of all because it has the most fat content, and fat is flavor, whether you like it or not. It's that's what happens. But we constantly get them. Not constantly is probably strong. We periodically get them sent back because it's fatty. But it's supposed to be fatty. That's where it comes from. There's a fat piece in the eye. There's a fat, you know, outer content. And that's why it tastes better than the other steaks.
I think the thing that definitely does it in for me is if I find a vein in a piece of meat. But
well, you know why that happens. Here's another, you know, I'll let you in on a secret. When you take a short loin, which is the New York strip, right, and you cut it, there's a good end and a bad end. You know, I mean, they're both fine meat, but one end has that vein that runs through it. And when I cut the steaks, I cut it up to that vein, and then I use the rest of that for other things. I'll grind it for hamburgers. I'll make bolognese. I'll do a stew, whatever, you know. And I basically cut that vein out. There was a prevailing thought over the course of history that you would cut those steaks and use them for well done. And so I remember when I never bought into that, but that there, a lot of people do that. And a lot of people just cut it and say to hell with it, you know, and then try and serve it. I think that's kind of a felony, you know, it's a restaurant felony. Anyway, so there's a cook here, and I won't tell you who he is, doesn't matter. But he was working with me for a while, and I see him cutting the steaks, and I see him, he get to the end, and he's cutting these steaks on the end. I said, well, what are you doing with those? He goes, well, you know, we'll give them to the people who want well done. I said, so why are you punishing somebody because they want well done meat? And he goes, what do you mean? I said, well, that vein is still there, whether it's rare, medium, or well, it's still there. You can't chew it. I don't get it, you know? But that was a headset for cooks for the longest time. They would take, you know, the lousy end and cut the steaks and use them for well-done pieces of meat. I just want to go on record saying I never did that, Stu, and I will not do that for the rest of my career. There's plenty of other ways to use that meat. And you know, even that strip of fat and grizzle on the outside of the New York strip, we take all of that off. So when you have a steak, a New York strip in one of my places, you get to eat 100% of that thing that comes out on the plate. You don't have to cut anything off. And I can't say the same about a lot of steakhouses around here. You know, I don't eat steak all that often, but every once in a while somebody will bogart me into splitting one. And I see that trim on the side. And it's not wrong, you know. I wouldn't do it. I think that if you pay for, if somebody says a 16-ounce sirloin, I think you should be able to have 16 ounces of edible food.
Well, it's funny. For some reason, that makes me think of buying, when you buy the strip of meat that filet mignon comes out of, that's filet of beef?
Yeah, it's a tenderloin of beef.
Tenderloin of beef.
Yeah, yeah.
So usually, I guess, you can buy a peeled version,
yeah,
or an untrimmed version.
Right.
And the trimmed version, the untrimmed version is less expensive. The peeled is...
Yeah, well, you're paying for the fat.
Right.
Yeah.
So like... Your mind always goes, oh, am I going to get a better deal if, you know, I ask for the, I guess if I have them trim it down, but you pay for the
yeah.
the big piece and whatever it comes down to, it is what it is. I agree with you. I mean, ultimately, you got to have a little fat on there for flavor. You just don't want it overdone.
The fat should be in the meat, the marbling, though, not on the outside and inedible. I always say that. It should be in the marbling of the meat. So if you buy prime sirloin or if you buy choice sirloin, there's a certain amount of marbling in that meat. That should take care of the flavor part. That trim on the outside, in my humble opinion, maybe not so humble, but in my opinion, should be gone. I don't think why put something out there that you can't eat? Unless it's a bone, you know what I mean? Which adds flavor anyway, and everybody understands you can't eat the bone. But, you know, the thing with the ounces is interesting because, you know, you say 16-ounce sirloin, if you got 2 ounces of stuff or 3 ounces of stuff that you can't eat, it's not a 16-ounce sirloin anymore. It's a 12-ounce sirloin or 13 or whatever.
It's interesting. You just said something about the bone. when I was having that brunch the other day, there was a young guy with his parents.
Yeah.
And they're chatting or whatever, and he had gotten, waffles and chicken. So it was fried chicken with waffles.
Sure.
And he starts getting into it. I guess he was a little bit of a foodie, and he said, you know, it was a poverty meal that,
sure. Classics. Fill you up, yeah.
But, and he goes, you know, it's fried chicken on the bone. You know, you got to have your chicken on the bone, otherwise it doesn't have taste. And I debate that a little bit because you can cook a chicken breast pretty nice and it's still juicy and has flavor. And
yeah, I go for thighs. I think, you know, thighs have flavor without the bone.
So as it turns out, I had, a foodie week. I got back to down the rabbit hole in South
America. Oh, yeah,
yeah,
Steve's place, yeah.
And I didn't get to see Steve, but the young lady that was with him that day was there and we usually end up at her table, and she takes care of us. It was sad to hear that you had mentioned that it came up in conversation that they had a flood.
Yes.
You were the one that brought it up.
Yeah.
Valerie had been working there.
Yeah.
But they've had that like 2 or 3 times since.
Well, they're in a precarious location. I mean, right at the end of the canal there, so.
But, you know, the food is really, really nice. Again, the cocktails there. So this is down the rabbit hole. Off of Hewlett, South Merrick. They have an extraordinary cocktail menu. I'm always perplexed on which way to go. They talked about a pickle juice martini mm-hmm. when we were here, and I didn't get that last time. I ended up going with their old fashioned, which was delightful. So this time I went the other way. Again, I keep hearing that it's trendy that people are using pickle juice in cocktails. It was an interesting additive. It sort of was like not sweet, but it wasn't the same as olive juice.
Yeah, no, it's a completely different flavor profile.
Yeah, so I thought it was a cute idea. It didn't bring it home for me.
Yeah.
But again, the food, and then the food there is great. The desserts are great. They have a whole bunch of dessert cocktails. I ended up going with duck breast. And usually when you get duck in most restaurants, it's like a half of the duck. And it's got a crispy skin on it or whatever. But I remember over at Jewel, you had duck breast on the menu.
Yeah, I prefer using a breast. First of all, they're easy to cook. I mean, the whole ducks are a pain in the rear end. I mean, they draw a lot of fat out. You know, it's precarious taking it out of the oven and the pans. And then, you know, there's this thing about crispy skin. And I think it was all born in the 40s when ducks started to get popular. And, you know, duck can be very fatty and say, I want a crisp skin. Because what happens is you render the fat out that's under the skin and But, you know, I get people ordering it sometimes, and it's the same people that order mint jelly with their lamb chops. You know, they're living in the 40s, and they'll say, you know, I want the duck breast, but make the skin crispy. Well, I can't really do that because I trim most of it off, you know. And what's left gets crisp anyway, and it's not a lot of fat there. There's nothing to really render out.
Yeah, recollect,
excuse me.
There wasn't any crispy skin surrounding it. They had sliced it like mm-hmm. medallions. It was actually, one thing that intrigued me is they had two different portions. Maybe one was 12 ounces, the other was 8 ounces, or 10 and 6, something like that, which I thought was interesting because I had never seen that before for duck.
Well, he does, on the same plate, or you're not talking about duck two ways or anything, right?
No, it was just different... a choice of a smaller portion or a larger portion.
Well, he bills that as a small plate restaurant, so that's probably so that's why that, yeah.
But it was very, I was intrigued. So it came out with the medallions. It seemed to be perfectly cooked. It was like brown on the edges, and then it got pinkish.
Yeah.
Maybe not pink, reddish in the middle.
Yeah.
It was just cooked perfectly. And if it was a little bland, this is sort of seems to be opposite what I said before.
Mm-hmm.
It had a nice sauce that it came with that when you dipped it into that, it
picked
just
it up.
Took it to the right place.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Steve's a good cook, you know. He's a good cook. Rabbit Hole.
I think it was like with a sweet potato puree or something.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's kind
of... So it was a real, again, great meal, and it's hard to have room for dessert there.
Yeah, I don't like to waste the calories so much on dessert because most of them are kind of the same, and I've sort of had them all, you know. Unless I go to a place that has, like, when Claudia Fleming was out at North Fork Table. I mean, she's a rock star dessert, you know, person. She's got a couple of books out, and, you know, I became friends with her over the years out there. Her husband, Jerry, sadly passed away from ALS, you know. And he was a talented chef also, you know. But they were a powerful combination. And so when I would go there, I would have dessert. They would usually send me out something or whatever. But when I go there, I had dessert because she was such a monster, you know. But most of the desserts you get in the restaurants, they're the same as a chocolate thing, a lemon thing, you know, a cheesecake thing, a bread pudding thing or whatever. I've had thousands of them. So I'd rather concentrate on Johnny Angel. No, I'd rather concentrate. It just snapped into my head. It was one of those things. I had no filter here this morning. It's probably the caffeine. But, you know, I don't know. I kind of lost my train of thought there. But
we're talking about desserts.
I'd rather concentrate on the entrees. And the, yeah, you do. Thank God. On the entree and the appetizer, because I find them infinitely more interesting, you know. And it saves me the calories. I mean, I need calories like I need another nose. So, you know, it's at this stage of my life, I'm trying to keep the weight under control and, you know, trying to stay slim to some degree and not go the sugar route as best I can.
Gotcha.
But they are. I mean, you get a good pastry chef and they can, you know, you can see God in some of this stuff. There was a guy, Richard Leach, in the city years ago who made these intricate desserts. I mean, I don't even know how he did it. It was like stuff sticking out all over the place. They had wires and trapezes, and it was like crazy, you know? Nuts.
So I go back to that North Shore restaurant, and for dessert...
This is the one that you didn't name?
I'm not naming.
Okay.
But
you'll tell me
well,
off.
First of all...
You'll tell me off air?
By the time they serve dessert, most of the a lot of the patrons had left.
Mm-hmm.
So much so that at our table...
Don't tell me you ate two.
There was probably 10 people. Only 6 were there for dinner, as it turned out.
Uh-huh.
And it was a shame because sitting next to me was a Bronzino that I tasted just to...
Yeah, well.
And then there was a couple of roasted chicken, which, again, I find kind of... I guess traditionally, you know, that's always the fundraising dinner, but I don't... I would never go for chicken as my... It was like a half a roasted chicken.
Yeah, well, you feel the same way as most people. That's why I don't serve them. You know, they're hard to get rid of.
So I actually regret that I didn't taste it because everybody was saying how wonderful it was. But my son was the real winner because, you know, the extra filet that was sitting there I brought home for him. But when it came to dessert, there was nobody there. And it was just funny. They rolled the trays out. And not only did they have the dessert on it, they had the plastic containers to take
Look
it home.
Look at you.
So, but they had like a, it was, I guess like a flan consistency, but it was white.
Yeah, so panna cotta.
And it had some berries on it.
Yeah, it's panna cotta probably.
Just didn't do it. I mean, like I know when I have flan, there's a decent drizzle of caramel.
Yeah.
This was berries, so there should have been some juice from that. No. And then they had a mousse, a moose cake, but it was individual.
Uh-huh.
But it was so, it wasn't, moose to me is usually a little gooey.
Yeah, moist moose.
Moist.
Yeah.
This was like a flourless.
Dry moose.
Chocolate cake.
Okay.
It was, you know, dry.
Yeah.
Just, the only good thing was the schlag or whatever they put on the side.
Boy, am I glad you didn't name this restaurant. But you're going to tell me if I'm going to beat it out of you if I have to. I'm curious now.
I was disappointed. But again, you say that for dessert, I'm really not a dessert guy. However, if I have to dig back into to the back of my mind, it's probably the best dessert I ever had. And it was when we commissioned Courtney to bake a cake for
Jim
Douglas.
Yeah, the golfing cake, right?
And it was incredible. It was a chocolate cake, like the height of like a layer cake.
Yeah.
And then on top there was like a sand trap, this, that, the other.
Yeah.
And I guess the sand trap was colored sugar or something, like brown sugar or something.
I think it was crumbs of some kind of
whatever it was.
Cake crumbs. Yeah.
But I've never ever tasted a chocolate, and it had to be moussey.
Yeah, there was mousse inside. You know, the thing I'll say about, and she's my daughter, so I'm a little bit biased.
I don't know if it was ganache or...
Yeah, it's ganache on top and mousse in the middle. But according to her credit, always used primo ingredients. She never really cut any corners. And she charged for it, you know, I mean, what you have to do, obviously. And she wasn't the cheapest cake around by far. But you got what you got. You know what I mean? It wasn't...
Well, so many cakes, if it's with fondant, the fondant is overdone. It's, you know, thick.
And, yeah.
This, again, it will remain in my soul that it was the greatest piece of dessert that I've ever had. And so much so, I brought it home to share with Mom at one point, because I guess we recorded on the weekend.
Yeah.
So it was Friday we spent with Jim and
I
took a piece home, so it just delightful.
Well, here's the thing, and I was talking about this with somebody a week ago, a week, 10 days ago, whatever, and I was doing a cooking demo at Pominock Vineyards, right? So I don't know how the subject come up, but I said, you know, my goal when I, you know, air fingers quotes, create a dish or make something is to freeze it in your memory. Like a photograph where you can go back to it, you know, and you can tell me exactly where you were and who you were with and what the weather was and what you were wearing or whatever. So it's so vivid in your mind. And it doesn't always happen, obviously, but that's the goal. And so here's proof of the pudding, right? I mean, Courtney used all the right ingredients. She used all top shelf stuff. And you're talking about it 4 years later, like it was the best cake you ever had. And the reason is because it was great. I mean, I go to these, you know, functions or, you know, people will bring in cakes to the restaurant, you know, from the local bakery or whatever. And I taste very few that move me in everyone's. And because I'm a sugar guy, you know, I got to be, you know, like I really have to be cognizant of the fact that I shouldn't be eating all of this stuff. But the bottom line is I'll always taste it just to see what it's like. And most of the cakes to me are mediocre at best to terrible at worst. And this is kind of the prevailing thought with a lot of businesses is that it's, you know, I understand that there's a profit motive and I get it that you have to pay the rent and everything else, but at some point there has to be some kind of concern towards the ingredients and the quality of what you're putting out. And I think most people will pay a little extra to have a cake, like you said, 4 years later, you're still talking about this cake, right? So if it was $15 more than the one that you can't eat, wouldn't you pay it? I mean, most people would.
Well, again, most people don't appreciate the cost of things. I guess within the past 10 years, these fondant cakes, you know, became popular, but because people were doing them in their own kitchen or whatever.
Yeah.
But... I had a friend that was, you know, doing it as a hobby and whatever, but she wanted to be paid for it. I mean, obviously there's some effort that goes into it and the supplies. People never understood the price. I guess, you know, if you have high production, I guess you can
volume.
Amortize the cost over your,
of course,
your inventory. But, you know, it always people like reluctantly, okay. But I guess in life, it's always that way. I mean, I always remember my dad, like, if he needed to get the washing machine fixed, you know, they want $100 just to get here.
Yeah.
Well, you think about it.
Yeah. It's gas, it's payroll, it's, you know, electricity in the office, it's the secretary, it's the the accountant, it's the lawyer, it's, you know, you gotta, yeah. Look, I think that I'm of the opinion that value comes in different price categories, right? Is there value in, let's say, a Hyundai car? I think so. I mean, they give a 10-year unconditional warranty on the powertrain. You know, they're not that expensive. You see a lot of them out now. Okay, fine. Is there value in a Ferrari? Yeah, there is. You know, it's a quality-made car. It goes fast as hell. It, you know, whatever. Looks great. You know, you can pull it up to singles night, and you're probably going to get a little recognition. But the bottom line is, you know, I think value in restaurants, it's the same thing. I think everybody has a certain amount of money that they're comfortable spending on a meal. All right. And as soon as they exceed that level, the discomfort level goes up exponentially. And then you have things like, well, it wasn't worth the money. Well, it was too expensive. Well, I think the thing is overpriced. Well, you shouldn't be there if you're not willing to pay that. I mean, you know, I've paid stupid amounts of money for dinner, and I never felt screwed. I felt screwed in places where I spent $40 and couldn't eat the food, you know? So it's really not, you know, is it overpriced? I don't know. What's overpriced mean? You know, nobody knows. I mean, my rent at Jewel was $45,000 a month. Was that overpriced? I mean, somebody's got to pay that, right? So the bottom line is, I think that if you go into a place that you're just not comfortable, you know, with the price structure, you probably should turn around and go someplace where you're comfortable rather than, you know, having this elevated expectation level that nobody can live up to, because no matter what happens, you're just PO'd about having to lay out that money.
Yeah. So, again, with your ranting and raving over there,
I'm getting mad now.
I had another flashback to this event the other night. So they were serving
sliders.
This
is the restaurant that you refused to name.
So they serve sliders.
I can't wait to hear this.
And it was cute because the slider had a little pickle on top. And
the standard.
You know, just like the pickle I had in my pickle martini.
Yes, it's probably where it came from.
But again, if you're at a function and it's cocktail hour and everybody's walking around and you're supposedly holding a drink, even if you don't drink, you got to hold the drink.
Of
just
course,
so you put it in.
Yeah.
Then you go to grab the slider. Well, first they want you to take a napkin. Again, it's all hard to balance and get done.
You need three hands for these things.
And with these sliders, for whatever reason, they must have had like a sautéed onion with a fig something. So it was greasy.
Sloppy.
And sticky.
Yeah, yeah.
So you grab it, your hand's all messed up.
Yeah.
But you can't put it in your mouth. First of all, it's got the pickle with the toothpick.
Yeah.
So I don't know how they expect you to navigate.
It's a dopey thing to pass.
So that then leads me to, when they serve baby lamb chops at an event, you know, it's sort of the same thing. You're ripping this thing apart.
I mean, I can almost get that because you got the handle, you know what I mean, with the bone. And you bite it, and, you know, but worst come to worst, you wrap the handle up in a napkin and hand it to a passing waiter. But, you know, to me, passing sliders is ludicrous. I mean, you can't, it's a two-handed thing. I don't care how big they are, right? I mean, it's one thing if they're on a buffet thing, like if you have an appetizer buffet, have there, you got a plate there, you put on a plate, civilized. You go to a table, you sit down, you eat it, you go, you know. But to stand around, you know, have it one hand, you get the napkin, you know, under your arm, you get the cocktail in the other hand, it's like, it's a mess.
Were you watching me?
I was. I've seen thousands of you in the place. People always insist, pass the sliders. I'm like, oh, God, please, put the dry cleaner on red alert, you know, because he's going to be very busy. It's some of it's dopey. You know, people, I just booked a wedding, right, for a catering company. And it's funny how I have to counsel these brides. They, you know, I understand it. They're excited. They're getting married. I get it. And their friends had this, and they had a pizza truck, and he had a guy come at 12 o'clock at night and serve cappuccinos, and we got this. calm down. You don't need an hour and a half cocktail party. You know what the result of that is? If you have 100 guests, 98 of them are looking at the ceiling 45 minutes later wondering when this thing is going to start so I can get out of here. Most people go to a wedding out of obligation, not because they're fun. There's an occasional guy that likes to do the Macarena or whatever, the dancing, you know. But most of us are there because we have to be there, not because we want to. We're assuming the meal's going to be lousy. You know, we're assuming the music isn't going to be good. You know, it's an obligation thing, which is fine.
I think I recollect your opinion of the mashed potato bar.
Oh, please. You know, really? I mean, have you run out of ideas? I mean, a mashed potato bar. Who eats for an appetizer? Who eats a bowl of mashed potatoes with bacon bits on them or whatever the hell they put on?
Well, I think the latest one I went to, not only did they had white mashed potatoes, and then they had sweet potato mashed potatoes.
No, there's an idea.
You know, and
yeah, wow.
Like you almost expect them to have sprinkles and mushrooms.
I wonder how they thought of that. Yeah, where did that come from? It's like, I don't know. You know, yeah, they got, you know, chives, and I mean, I go to Rothman's occasionally, and I don't really eat steak. And I swear to you, almost 9 times out of 10. We'll split a baked potato and I'll order a cream spinach. That's my dinner, right? And you know, 2 bottles of Burgundy or whatever. But the the baked potato is the size of a football. It's nuts, right? I think you know, send somebody over here to carve this thing. You know, it's crazy. And then they give you this buffet thing of, you know, bacon and chives and sour cream and butter and lions and tigers and bears. Oh my, you know. But I kind of like, I mean, I can get a little sour creamy and I can get a little oniony, you know, with the chives. But the rest of it is, I don't know, bacon bits, if they're right out of the oven and somebody chops them quick and you put them on there, they're great. But bacon that's been sitting around getting cold all day with the fat coagulating, why are you putting this on? It's terrible.
Wait, so now that brings me to the latest thing at steakhouse is the...
The bacon on
the
thick
cut bacon.
Yeah.
And when you were talking about, you know, serving a steak and not having the rim of fat around it or whatever.
Yeah.
Bacon is fat.
Oh, total fat, but it's different.
But it's different.
Yeah, it's different. I mean, that's good fat. It's chewy. I mean, it's not like you can't get through it. You know what I mean? The fat around the side of a strip, try eating that. You can't bite through that because there's a layer of silver skin under
it. And I was at a restaurant recently where they had an old-fashioned that somehow had bacon... cured bacon as part of the
flavoring.
Yeah,
well, they've been trying to put bacon in everything for years. I mean, I'm guilty of it too. I mean, I put bacon in bread pudding, in like a pumpkin bread pudding.
I guess people do that. I mean, you sometimes see shrimp in a Bloody Mary or maybe even an oyster.
Yeah, it's, you know, yeah, it's fun. I mean, you know, it's decorated differently or whatever. I know Guy Fieri has a Bloody Mary that's got about 9 pounds of things on it, you know. He's got, I don't know, a shrimp, celery, a taco, you know, 2 hamburgers, a slider, and this Bloody Mary. It's crazy. So I think those are restaurants that are kind of like the Friday-ish, you know, kind of chainy kind of things that are looking for something different to, I guess, set them apart.
So I got to throw this at you. I hope it's not a bad flashback. Experiential dining. Again, my friend that I went out to breakfast with, his birthday, he's a leap year baby.
Ah, well.
So happy birthday, Marty.
Yeah, he's 7 years old now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we were trying to figure out, you know, what can we do to celebrate with him? He's somebody that's sort of well-to-do, so he pretty much can
do whatever he wants. Yeah.
So I said, oh, wow, what about the TWA Hotel and having a meal there?
Sure.
Came to me. So I did a little research last night, and apparently Jean-Georges is the chef.
Oh, yeah, he took it over? I didn't realize that.
And I was just curious if you had any insight to the restaurant and the menu or whatever.
I can tell you one thing. Don't wear Crocs if you're going in there. You'll be unceremoniously removed, as I was.
I told you a couple of weeks ago. Again, the friend from New Orleans has an apartment in the building there, and she said she was afraid to go downstairs, you know, not dressed to her not in her
Sunday best, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
I said, well, you should be concerned because
I was thrown out. Who knows? No, you know, Jean-Georges is a player, man. I mean, he's one of the top guys on the planet. You know, he does a great job. He's got about 30 restaurants all over the world now. I remember when I was in Montauk, he was just starting out at his place called, what was it called? Oh, it'll come to me. He had Vong and he had the first one. Anyway, his partner, his financial partner, he used to come to my restaurant in Montauk all the time, telling me how good he was and, you know, what a great chef and whatever. And I went into to his restaurant. I agreed. I thought he was great, you know. And it's played out that way because he's been very, very successful. He's opened up restaurants all over the world. So I'm sure that, you know, I don't know what the food's there. I wasn't aware that he was involved in that.
It's the Paris Cafe by Jean George.
Yeah, well, if it's by Jean George, it's good. I mean, he does a good job.
And I'm going to just quickly read you some. I was intrigued by the menu, but I was...
He repeats a lot of stuff. I mean, and you would have to if you have that many restaurants. You know, there's only so many things you can do well. So no harm in you know, copying some dishes here and there. I just found out that an ex, I don't want to call him protege, but an ex guy I know is working on a different place in Long Island now, and I'm starting to see a lot of familiar dishes on the menu. Imagine that.
So at the restaurant, at the TWA Hotel at Kennedy, for salads, they have a Caesar salad. This one seems intriguing. A beet Greek, which, interesting. I guess it's not crazy to think of beets being in a
Greek salad.
So that one, shaved broccoli, kale, escarole, and apple. Mm-hmm. Those are the salads. For appetizers, crispy salmon sushi, burrata and fig, butternut squash soup, meatballs, a smoked chili tomato ragu.
Nice.
Delicata squash, half-roasted cauliflower, yellowfin tuna tartare, crispy calamari. Then they have a selection of pizzas.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought that was kind of weird.
Yeah, Paris pizzas.
Yeah. Then they have, for entrees, pretty limited, salmon, fish and chips, tagliatelle with mushroom bolognese,
mm-hmm,
roasted cauliflower, and a turkey burger.
Nice.
So as much as I want to go there, I'm confused about that. Maybe it's misrepresenting what the menu is.
Well, I'm sure it's all done well. I mean, airport dining for me is a necessity, not a choice.
Not necessarily the selection I would do for dinner, I'm thinking. That
right.
Seemed more like a lunch
menu. Yeah, an afternoon thing, you know.
But we'll find out.
You want to take them to a great place. You ever been to the Modern in MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art? They have a restaurant there that's spectacular.
Is it hard to get into?
I don't know. I haven't tried to make a
reservation.
What's it called? It's called The Modern.
The Modern.
The Modern.
I have heard about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it's great.
And that actually might trump my thought of the TWA.
Yeah, that's the one. And you can go, you know, I mean, I was doing that in New Orleans. I was, you know, browsing galleries all day, you know, because I'm an art freak, you know. But you can go see the museum stuff and then have lunch there or
so
dinner.
Going back to your trip to New Orleans, if I'm not mistaken, you said you did gumbos for breakfast.
Yes.
You're my type of guy.
I'm not an egg guy. So, I was talking to my granddaughter last night. She goes, I always ask them what they want for breakfast. I'll go to the bagel store. Paco, I'm into protein breakfast. Well, you know, what can you suggest? Eggs, I don't know, you know. I said, what about salmon? She looked at me like I was nuts. How about a steak? Are you kidding? But I would eat that for breakfast. I don't have any interest in eggs over light or scrambled eggs
or
omelets.
Yeah, I can do a salad in the morning.
Yeah, right? me too. But listen, we have to get out of here. Salads or not, it's that time. So we're going to say goodbye for another week and sign.
And I guess in the near future, we should be talking about Easter.
Yeah, we should. It's coming up, right? Easter and Passover.
And Easter and Passover are like...
They're separated this year?
Passing ocean.
All right, so we're going to close the show with Tom's three keys to life. Life is too short for passing oceans. Treat every meal like it was your last. And keep chocolate in your life as important as sex and pizza. And I'll see you next week.
Amano Osteria and Wine Bar has been created by Adam Lovett and Tom Shawdell to bring the feel and flavors of a true Tuscan Osteria to the North Fork. Amano showcases local growers, farmers, cheese, and winemakers, marrying their ingredients with the taste traditions of the Tuscan countryside. The casual appeal, the flavors of Italy, and a moderate price structure appeal to all, ensuring year-round patronage. This North Fork eatery sends out snappy salads and seafood, pastas and antipasta, along with a respectable wine list. Amano features local vineyards and Italian varietals from the U.S. and Italian wines. The kitchen remains open until 11 and has established a later dining crowd, sparking a local nightlife dining scene. Amano is on the cutting edge of a new high-quality and affordable dining experience on the North Fork. Amano Osteria and Wine Bar, 13550 Main Road in Matatuck. Serving dinner daily, Amano is also open for lunch on Saturday and Sunday. For reservations and further information, call them at 631-298-4800 or visit them on the web at AmanoRestaurant.com.